So welcome to another day's talk about meditation. What happens and how it happens and what to expect and how wonderful meditation can be. So if what was mentioning yesterday in the morning talk, how that when we do get into any problems in meditation, that is actually where we use wisdom, power, not willpower. We investigate what's the problem, what do we want, what are we holding on to, and that's where we start getting some insights. We start getting insights into the nature of the mind, the nature of life. And you know it's an insight. Sometimes people ask me, when do you know it's an insight, or when it's just another thought, another theory? You know it's a real insight because once you see it, you get peaceful and you feel free. You know, real insights unlock doors which have contained you and imprisoned you, and now you're free. So then that is a sign of insight, because sometimes, you know, people, they can sit in a chair like this and they can say all sorts of profound things. You know, I also like profound thing to say, like it's all one, everything is empty, just, what was that? I'm going to be profound insight at the moment. But all those things are just so superficial. You may say them, they may sound really interesting, they may appear very profound, but do they cause peace and happiness? There's one great saying of the Buddha, and I remember this from a long time ago, and I repeated it very recently. When someone asked me, actually, how do you know that it's truth? How do you know that you're going on the right path? How do you know that this meditation is going in the right direction? Yeah, you may have faith in a monk like me, but then you go to another retreat and somebody says something else, and then you read a book and you have another idea. So how do you know it's really truth or not truth? And this was a teaching which the Buddha gave to the monk Upali. He also gave it to the first bhikkhu, Mahaprajapati. And he said, if it's something which leads to peace, which leads to freedom, which leads to turning away from things, letting them go, which leads to things ending, which leads to nirvana, then that, you know, is the teaching of the Buddha. That is the Dhamma. There's a very, very good little saying in Greek, because when he gave it to Upali, that's all he got, and then he went off to meditate and became enlightened, became an arahant, just from those very simple teachings. So you know it's the truth, you know it's working by its results. So if it really is an insight, you really see the problem, it solves the problem, so you get more peaceful. So as you are meditating, you have to solve many problems in meditation. If you follow my method and you're enlightened, it's very easy. You just go straight into jhanas, no problems at all. But how many of you could do that? It is because we've got so many little blockages on the path. And when we have little blockages, and we find out what's going on there, when we go through those blockages, that's where we learn the Buddha's teachings. And little simple things. Now the common problem with many of you, because you know, you've been meditating a lot, many of you, and you've had experiences before, and you can't get them back again. And you know, that is one of the big problems. It certainly happened to me the first time I got a very deep meditation experience. I was still a lay person. It took about 3 or 4 years to get back there. And of course I didn't have that many instructions. Ajahn Chah would teach, but I would never really understand what he was getting on about. It was only after you really let go and you stopped trying to attain those things, and instead you just, I wanted to be peaceful, that's all. I had enough of trying to get back there, just causing me too much suffering. So I just let things be. And of course, as soon as you let things be, all these things happened. Now straight away, you get the great insight that all wanting actually disturbs the mind. Every aspiration, every expectation, this makes the mind get more agitated. And you soon realize that the job of meditation is not to aspire for anything. The aspiration is usually where it starts. And when you start from aspiration, you usually very quickly go on to the next aspiration, which is called desperation. And then the third spiration is expiration, where you give up and totally do something else. So be careful of the three spirations: aspiration, desperation, and expiration. Instead, we don't aspire to do anything. It's a very radical teaching. This is where you understand the insight in the nature of suffering at all levels is because we want things. Now, of course, people keep telling me, but if you follow that path, Ajahn Brahm, we won't do anything in this world. We won't be able to go to work. We have no aspirations, no desires. We won't make any money. We can't all become monks and nuns. And I agree with you. We've got no space. We're busy building space. We can't take on all of you at the end of this retreat. But of course, you do work when it's time to work, when it's time to let go. That's when you have no aspirations at all. And I tell my monks that your effort stops once you get onto your meditation cushion. To get onto the cushion takes the effort, but once you're there, stop and let go and be peaceful. Leave it all alone. Don't do a thing. Because every time you do something, you are disturbing the natural peace of the mind. And you're making all of these great experiences more distant from you. Now that sounds very good, but people don't do it. They're always getting interfering a little bit. And of course, if any of you have that experience when you start, say, watching the breath is not peaceful, it's not comfortable. And you can understand why. It's because most people, whatever they watch, they interfere with. The example I usually give is that once when I was visiting England, I was picked up at Heathrow Airport by one of the disciples. Because she was a woman, she got her son to go with her. Because that's one of the rules, not to be alone with a woman. There's a good reason for that, because if I'm alone with a woman, even in a car, now even I'm a very good man, people don't know. And they start spreading rumours. And the suspicions of the malicious, well, I don't know if Ajahn Brahm is a good man. They spent a whole hour in the car with that girl. I'm not quite sure what they got up with. Who knows what might have happened? And it's true, you know, sometimes you've got to be very careful that way. You know, not putting yourself in a position where, you know, people can doubt you. So, you know, just ask, can you have a guy there with you? So, yes, fair enough. And so he was the driver, and I was sitting in the passenger seat, and this woman was sitting in the back seat. And for an hour, it took an hour to get to the place where I was staying. And for every moment of that hour, she was giving instructions to her son. Don't drive so fast. Keep to the left. Don't run that light. Let that person in. Oh my goodness, I've never ever seen such a backseat driver in my life. And I think you can relate to that because you've probably done the same with your husband, your sitting passenger. Darling, don't go so fast. You're going over the speed limit. Look, slow down. Turn left. This is the best way, not your way. I know this way. No, no, this is much better, but there's more traffic that way. Why do people do that? It's because we always like to control things. Whatever we watch, we tend to control. Or you may be going to somebody's house and they're cooking dinner and you can say, no, don't do it this way, do it that way. It's not even your house. You tell other people what to do. So, you can understand why when you're watching your breathing, why you get involved. You are the backseat driver again. Now your lungs are doing the breathing. Say, no, don't do it this way, do it that way. I know the best way. I've been meditating the long way. Ajahn Brahm said you should do it this way, but don't do it that way. Do it fast, don't do it slow. Don't worry. And you're such a backseat driver to meditation, which is one of the reasons why it never gets comfortable. Sometimes that happened to me. Whenever I started watching my breath, it took a long time to calm it down. But when I was doing something else, you know, doing some building or just talking to people, my breath was always really calm. Whenever I didn't get involved, my breath went perfectly. But as soon as I started watching it, I started to interfere with it. And that gave me a great insight. The insight, whenever we watch something, whenever we feel it, taste it, we tend to own it and get involved with it. So you have to be able to watch without getting involved. Now there's many tricks to that, many great insights. One of the tricks which I've been using recently is actually get the attitude of being a visitor rather than an owner. For example, you're staying in this hotel, and in your room there may be some things which are not working very well. I know my shower handle, you know, it's a service. Sometimes the hot water comes on, sometimes it doesn't come on. It's just the tap, that's all. But you know, I don't really care because I'm leaving tomorrow. It's somebody else's problem, who cares? As long as I get a hot shower and just manage to do it now, I don't really care because it's not my room. I can let it go. If you're going to somebody else's house, you know, if the paint needs repainting or this dirty stuff here and there, you don't really care too much about it. It's not your business. It's not your house. When you're a visitor, you can enjoy without having to fix everything up. So when I meditate, I also try and get the attitude of being a visitor. I'm visiting my mind, but I don't own it. So if there's anything wrong with my mind, it's not my problem. The mind's problem. You fix that yourself. I'm just going to watch. If you're sleeping, rest, it's nothing to do with me. That's your problem. So I do absolutely nothing. Washing my breath, whatever it's doing, it's your mind's problem. You know how to breathe. I'm not going to tell you how to breathe. I'm not going to be a backseat driver. When I'm a visitor, not an owner, the life goes so much more peacefully. That's one of the factors of anatta, non-self. I don't own anything, therefore I can enjoy it without interfering with it. When I get on the aircraft tomorrow, I'm not going to tell the pilot how to fly the plane. I'm not going to say, look, I'm in a hurry, can you take shortcuts? Can you put your feet on the gas, please? We've got a rush. You can't do that in an aircraft. That's one of the nice things about flying. It reminds me that now you sit back and do nothing. This is nothing you can do. You're a visitor. You don't own the flight. So I can remember that when I'm meditating. You see an imitator. It's nothing to do with me. I'm only a visitor. I don't own that imitator. So whatever wants to do, wants the car flash up, go here, go there. I don't care what you do. I don't interfere. And you find that you don't interfere when you're not the owner anymore, but just a visitor. Because you don't get involved, you can relax and enjoy yourself. It's the same when people come to visit, say, Jhana Grove, or they come and visit my meditation center, or Bodhidharma Monastery. You know, for so many years, people would come and they'd see that monastery, and they'd say, what a beautiful monastery that is. And I would think, are you kidding? Look at all the leaves which need to be swept. Look at all the things which need to be fixed up. Can't you see now the paint peeling on the wood of the main drama hall? They couldn't see that. You know why? Because they were visitors. As for me, I was Abba. I was the owner. I could see all the things which need fixing. But so for me, that monastery wasn't beautiful. It was my workplace. So I could never appreciate and relax in my own monastery. And this is what happened for quite a few years until I saw what was going on. Got an insight. I knew as an insight that the problem was solved. My problem was that I would work in our city centre for Friday afternoon through Saturday and Sunday and come back Sunday evening, feeling tired, you know, running one centre, and then come back and Monday morning start working in Bodhidharma Monastery. Basically, I was running two jobs. So 7 days a week. You're getting quite tired. And I couldn't just relax in my own monastery where I live, because that was my office, that was the place I had to work. People would come there and they would just relax and enjoy themselves. And I said, I can't talk to you, I've got to answer the phone, someone's dying in hospital. I've got to write this article for the Buddhist Fellowship magazine, I've got to talk to somebody, I've got to do something, I have so much stuff to do. You know why? Because of my workplace. I owned it. So I decided that one morning every week, or usually on Monday morning, but I will put in my head, I do not own this monastery, that I am a visitor. And I pretended that I was just like you, visiting the monastery, with no responsibilities, no duties. I wasn't a boss, I wasn't a manager, I wasn't an owner. I was a visitor. And then when I was a visitor on Monday mornings, I can enjoy the place, just like you can. I would walk around and see all the beautiful trees and how tranquil it all was. I could see that monastery through your eyes, not as an owner's eyes. And then I could be peaceful. I could relax, I didn't need to feel with it. And I enjoy the peace of that monastery, as you do. But once you're an owner, you can't enjoy the peace. There's too many things to be fixed up. So that's how I decided to have one morning a week, really relaxing, enjoying myself, and having some peace. I deserved it. It was very well worthwhile. But it also gave me a great insight into how to make the mind peaceful. If you own your meditation, you're really concerned about it, only one day left, you haven't got anywhere yet, only 24 hours, and you get very upset if you don't get at least a limiter by the tomorrow before you leave. All this money, all this time, you really sacrificed a lot to get here, you haven't got a limiter, how can you face your friends when they say, hey, how did you do today? And then your friends say, oh, I've got a limiter, actually I've got jhana this retreat, this is gone, I didn't get anything, this is terrible. You feel so upset. So no, don't own your meditation. Just be a visitor. If it's a visitor, you've got no problems, nothing to do, it doesn't belong to you. You can totally let your body and mind be. So when you shut your eyes for the next meditation, you're just visiting your head, you're visiting your mind. You're not an owner. You can just, like this resort, like this hotel, you can come, whatever's wrong with it, doesn't matter. Somebody else will fix it up when you're gone. It doesn't belong to you. Then you can have some peace. That's one of the reasons why people leave their home to go on holidays. At first I could never understand that. Why do people, especially in Australia, got beautiful houses? They've got a swimming pool in the back. They've got their own bed, huge TVs. What do? They go off to a hotel a long distance away, having to go through all the customs and immigration, wait for the plane to take off, sit in these really cramped chairs, get very uncomfortable, and when they get to the destination, they have to go through immigration, queuing up, waiting for their bags, and then getting a taxi, and it's really tired, and when they get there, they've got this big house with a swimming pool and a nice TV. Exactly what they've got back home. What are they doing that for? The main reason why people go on holiday, because to change that perception. It's not my home. This hotel, I could go business in, just even if it needs to be decorated, it's not my problem. So you don't have the responsibility. That's the only reason you escape, not for more comfort, but for no responsibility. You'd be free of all of that. That gives you so much peace. So I decided it's too expensive, to go traveling all over the world just for peace. So I decided wherever I go, I'm going to have no responsibility. I'm the most irresponsible abbot you can imagine. So I don't own the place, I don't own people, I don't even know my own meditation. So, okay, whatever you want to do, it's your problem, not mine. And then you can understand how you get peaceful. When I see my breath, it's not my breath, it's my lungs' breath. The lungs over there, they call all the shots. It's okay, lungs, I'm just watching your breath, I'm just visiting you. I'm not owning you, I've got no responsibility. If you forget to breathe, that's your problem, not mine. So that way, you find you're not a backseat driver. And when that woman shut up, and she did tell her son how to drive, he drove very, very well. But when she was on his case all the time, he got so nervous, and that's when he did almost have a crash. Because he was paying half attention to his mother, and only sort of 50% attention to the road. That's what happens when you try and control things, it gets worse. So you get a little insight about this, no control, just with your breath. And it gets really smooth when you don't get involved, when you don't own it. You get a little insight into no controlling, no desire, and also no self, not really mine. And as you go deeper and deeper, just quite naturally, you get delightful breath. Now, it is delightful, and many of you have sat here enjoying your meditation. Please go inside. Why is that happy? It's really weird, isn't it? Sitting here, no TVs, no sex, no music, no entertainment, and you'll be happy as anything just sitting here having a wonderful time. And you know that's happy because many people do that. They go on retreats, and they go back afterwards, and they say, it's the best few days of my life. You could have gone to Club Med, you could have gone to the Great Wall of China, you could explore the Amazon, you could have climbed Mount Everest. But never was peaceful and happy. This is spending a few days sitting on your bum, doing nothing, and just meditating. Why? A lot of people want the secret of happiness. And they go all over the world seeking happiness. They search the sense pleasures. They go and visit the Berlin Philharmonic. They go and see the greatest dancers in the Royal Opera House at Covent Garden. They try and have the most amazing experiences. And they travel and travel and travel, still they're not satisfied. They go and visit the wide regions of France. They go to the great restaurants in Paris, or the nightclubs in New York. They want to find happiness and fulfillment. And do they really find it there? Some of you have been there and done that. But where do you find real happiness? Compare it. And I'm not joking here that many of you will find more happiness just on your meditation cushion in this hotel, not having eaten all evening. You find more happiness here than you can find in any other place in the world. So much so that if we offered you a ticket, you don't have to still do another day's meditation. Offer you a ticket anywhere in the world, first class, to go and see the London Olympics or whatever, or would you prefer to stay and meditate? What would you do? I think many of you would take the ticket to the London Olympics. But some of you wouldn't, and you're the wise people. So no, I'm just happy meditating here. I don't want to go anywhere. But actually, this is what happens. You actually really taste some incredible states of happiness, and even delightful breath. Now, when you have those great experiences, you create insight. Why is that happy? Why, if you're sitting here watching the breath for an hour, with no sensory stimulation, there are no great sounds in the great orchestra, and no beautiful sights like waterfalls or mountains. Why is this happening? When conventional wisdom would say this would be boring. You get a secret of happiness. And it's a secret of happiness which is what the Buddha kept on talking about, you know, the Four Noble Truths. And as I say, what is that Four Noble Truths? In brief, put all in one. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So when you stop wanting, then you begin to enjoy what you have. When you let things be, that's where enjoyment begins. When you want something, you have all this business to do, try to get what you want, and that just tires you out. When you stop wanting. That's where enjoyment begins. And if you stop wanting long enough, the enjoyment grows and grows and grows. And that is the bliss of meditation. These moments, minutes, sometimes hours, of not wanting anything. Not worrying about the bills you have to pay. Not worrying about your kids or your husband, your wife. Not worrying about your health, not worrying about your finances, not worrying about the Buddhist fellowship or Bodhinyana monastery back and forth. You're sitting here perfectly free, having nothing to do, no wants. Now you can enjoy. And my goodness, it really becomes enjoyment. You realize the great insight that when you start wanting things, unfortunately, you have to in this life. It's a burden, you have to do it, but please, not all the time. How much do you really need in life? Or rather, how much do you want? The two are very different. And after a while, you know that I've got so much less than you have, and I'm content. But each one of you, you've actually got far too much, and you know that. You know that, but you don't really believe it, because you can always do with some more. So how big a house do you need? I tell everybody that the only house you really need is a wooden one, about 6 foot long, 2 foot wide, because you're going to spend more years in that than you're going to spend in any condo or any big house. That's the only house you really need, and that's pretty cheap. But we always want bigger things. You know, there was an article in the newspaper which somebody emailed to me, and it was, you know these newspaper editors, they gave these really silly headlines. They say, the article was headed, "Honey, I can't find the kids." And what it was, there was a woman in the UK who'd won the British lottery. It was £41 million she won, clear, no tax. £41 million she won in the lottery. And one of the first things she did was to buy a big mansion in the countryside. You know those big country houses you may see in the movies. She sold it 1 year later at a loss. And they asked her why she sold it. And she said because in that big house she could never find her two children. One child was in one wing of the house, another child was in another part of the house, her husband was in another part of the house, and she was another. There were so many rooms, they split her family up. She hardly ever saw her family because their house was that big. But she realized that it was more important to see each other than to have this big mansion. So she sold it and bought a very small house. It didn't look very good, but she said, in that small house I can see my husband, I can see my children every day. We can't escape from each other. We have our love, we have our family. In the big house, she lost that. When I heard that, I thought, more my disciples in first, stop upgrading to a bigger house. As you go up in your career, as your salary increases, please don't try and get bigger houses. Keep those small apartments, you know, in Singapore or wherever you are. And in the small apartments, you see each other all the time, every day. In the big mansions, you hardly ever meet, except by appointment. It breaks the family down. So when you see that, what do you really want in life? You know, the big house, the big car. Oh, yes, we want love, we want peace, we want our friendships, we want a beautiful family. How can you put a price on that? Friendship and fellowship and people who love you and you love them and you have fun together. There are so many lonely people in big mansions. So don't be one of them. So how much do you really want? How much do you really need? A lot of time, you don't need that much. How many clothes do you need? You can actually see that's why you have big suitcases. And look, this is not a fashion parade at a retreat. So you really just need two clothes, just one to change when the other one's being washed. You don't have to have clothes for the morning and clothes for lunch and clothes for the evening and your evening clothes and everything else. It's such a hassle, isn't it, having to dress up. So keep it simple. When it's really simple, you don't find you don't need very much. And because you don't want very much, you're more content, you're more happy. It's one of the problems with our modern world. We've asked the world so much, we've lost our happiness. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. When you stop wanting, it's amazing just how much you have, you really enjoy it. Simple things, each other's company. Just enjoy having a walk by the beach. Just enjoy just meeting your friends. Simple joys which cost absolutely nothing. They're the best in life. So when you start just to be content, you find the secret of happiness. It's an amazing thing which people go all over the world trying to find. The secret of happiness is called contentment. Happy to be here, no matter where that happens to be in life. Again, not all the time you have to work because that's our job and that's our duty. You made me work hard enough, so I can't get away with that. Don't see why you should. I work hard, so you have to work hard too. But when I stop and I'm just content where I am. And in that, that's meditation. And when you're content, happy to be here, you find the secret of happiness. The secret is not the law of attraction. That's why I really dislike that book, because that just creates more desire. If you think of the $10,000 check, you visualize it, it's in your post office box right now. It's in your letterbox waiting for you to return from the retreat. It's there, visualize. Believe it, don't doubt. If you doubt, it won't be there. And you visualize it, and then it's there. That's what they promise. When I read that, I thought, oh, come on, you stupid people. Who would actually believe that sort of stuff? Thousands of people do. No, the real secret is this: when you stop wanting, you find you have everything you ever wanted. You've already got it. You've already arrived. Which we don't realize that. Just letting go of craving, you're at peace, you're happy, and you bliss out. It is the wanting which stops you being happy. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And this is not to say, you may make sense to you, some of you might argue with that, but you test it out during your meditation. I did that for 2 or 3 years. That was my mantra. No desire. No desire. No desire. When I was meditating, if I saw any desire come up in my mind, even desire for good things, I squashed it. So I spent a whole 2 or 3 years not desiring anything as a monk. Amazing just how deep my meditations became. I didn't desire jhanas, I didn't desire limitless, I didn't desire peace, I didn't desire anything. I just totally let go. And I get a great insight into this. This is how you're peaceful. It doesn't matter if you're sleepy, it doesn't matter if you're sick, it doesn't matter if you're poor. The external situation, that's not the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is, do you want to be here or do you want to be somewhere else? Do you want to be you or do you want to be somebody else? If you want to be somebody else, you're suffering. If you're just happy to be this stupid, fat English monk, that's why I will not take your advice on not having big breakfasts in the morning. I'm not going to do that. Why? Because I like who I am. I'm at peace with my tummy. And I've got lots of kindness. In the morning, when I see all that food, I say, the door of my mouth is open to you. Okay, but I'm really happy, and so I have a lot of fun. That's why I'm healthy. No, that's not another part. Miserable people, they're the ones who die young. They're the ones who get sick. I go past that gym every now and again, and I sympathize with all those people having to really work hard on those treadmills. You know, that's what they used to do for prisoners in England in that last century, have to go on these treadmills to make them work really hard. I think, you must have done some very bad karma to have to torture yourself like that. But I've never seen any of them happy and smiling. They're very, they're gritting their teeth on those treadmills. Now that is the main problem. At very least, if you go on that treadmill, please smile. Otherwise it's not going to work. The happiness bit, which is the main key of health. So please remember that happiness, keep joy in your heart. And that's what the other insights you get. It was really weird for me that, I was used to eat the same food as other people, really gross food in Thailand, the frogs and the snails. I don't know what sort of bacteria stuff was in there. But no, the villagers were really dirty, there was all sorts of stuff pouring over everything. Well, I very rarely got sick. Other monks did. We ate the same food. There was malaria in Thailand. I never got malaria. There's all these other bugs and stuff in there. People told me that the jungles in Thailand was a bacterial soup. So, you cut yourself and there's all sorts of bugs that are going to get into you. But it was very healthy. And what was the difference between me and the other monks? You asked those monks, I was happy. The other monks were miserable, or they were afraid, and they're the ones who got sick. Can you see there's something there? You get a great insight. One of the most important reasons for good health is your happiness. If you're miserable, if you're afraid, if you're anxious, that's what gives you the bad health more than anything else in this world. So even when you're meditating, that's one of the reasons why when you meditate and all these amazing things happen to your health, you start to get tumors shrink, and this psoriasis vanishes, aches and pains disappear, all sorts of amazing stuff happens. Why? It's because only when you're peaceful when you meditate, you start getting happiness. That happiness is mental energy, that really heals you, keeps you going. So you get a great insight in how to be healthy. And it's not just health and having a long life. What's the point of a long life if you're miserable? That's more torture, isn't it? If you're so miserable and really having a tough time. I remember somebody showed me this research which was done in UK. People who had cardiac problems, they were advised to have a specific diet. Some people did follow the diet, and other people just followed their normal diet, you know, fish and chips, burgers, and roast beef, and all this other sort of so-called unhealthy food. And they found there was no difference in the death rate, the survival rate. People who followed the diet, people who didn't, had the same sort of prognosis in the length of life. And in this article of it, the doctors were thinking, why? Because, you know, some food is more healthy than others. You can see why, and there's a reason for that. But they decided, and this was their conclusion, which I laughed when I read it, said, yes, the health benefits, you know, of so-called healthy food, they are outweighed by being depressed because you can't eat the food you like. So yeah, you get a nice healthy diet, but you have an unhappy mind. And that balances it out, so you die the same. But I'm saying this, and I'm being quite serious. It's not so, you know, trying to excuse, you know, my diet. This is just as I know, and I've seen this so many times, people who really get obsessed with their healthy diet, they have no found happiness, and they're the ones who get sick. You get the insight, because when you're happy, you actually feel the health benefits of it. And you don't need to go and have all these stimulants and stimulating your senses to be happy. Just sitting here and just doing nothing, you realize when you don't want anything, you can start enjoying life. And I said, you know, you're soon going to have to go back to where you can't do that all the time. But at least spend some part of your week wanting nothing. Meditating, you could be sitting in your garden having a cup of tea, but please spend time doing nothing, just wanting nothing, just being there, resting, and being happy. You find you can enjoy things then. I know it's very difficult, especially in Singapore, to be someone who does nothing. Because the problem is, now, if in a Buddhist fellowship Angie sees you doing nothing, she'll give you something to do. It's a bad idea. And if you give Angie something to do, she's done it. But I have all these skillful means. So it's not really lying, but it's using skillful speech. When people ask me to do something, I say, sorry, I'm busy. One of my excuses is I'm watching the trees grow. But you can't watch a tree grow, can you? It's just an excuse for doing nothing. Really, I'm doing nothing. If I say I'm doing nothing, people give me something to do. So I pretend I'm just watching the trees grow. Or if you're sitting in the beer, you say, I'm just watching the carpet wear out. It does wear out. But you're just watching. So it just makes us no excuse to do nothing, because you deserve to do nothing. Why in life are we always supposed to be doing something? Because it's as if we don't do anything, it's somehow wrong or evil. Now I heard that, you know, when I was a young man. Now I wasn't really a Christian, because I was baptized, but it was against my will when I was only about a few weeks old. I'm sure I cried at the time. But you're exposed, you know, to Christianity. They have this Puritan saying that the devil makes work for idle hands. That's a terrible saying, which meant that people got so stressed out and they could never relax and rest, because if you were idle and did nothing, you'd think that something evil was going to happen, which meant you became total control freaks, working your butt off, never enjoying anything in life. But that's totally wrong. And when you have idle hands, you have happiness. You deserve to have a rest. And don't ever think, if I just carry on like Ajahn Brahm, the economy of Singapore will really go down, because no one is working, no one is aspiring, we don't get anything done if we don't have plans and goals. Actually, you get more done. when you know how to rest, you become more efficient. You won't have so many people off work in the hospitals in Singapore with all these diseases. Simply because you're happy and healthy, you rest more. So it's a brilliant insight to have. But you really get much deeper in meditation. When you get into these limiters, that's really amazing stuff. I have to check with Ajahn Brahmani. He's a monk who knows more than I taught in Pali, and now he knows much more than I do, which is a bit of a problem for me, because sometimes I get things wrong. Before, when I got things wrong, nobody knew I got things wrong. But now he knows more than me. He wants to know. He was saying that they have this phrase like Utri Manusa Dhamma. These are the things which you're not supposed to talk to other people about. This is literally like really high attainment states. You know, the stages of enlightenment, the jhanas are one of them, but he found one passage where they even called the nimittas, the things you shouldn't tell other people about. Because these are really superior human states. This is really getting way up there in sort of the path of Buddhism. And he's got a point there. Because even when you get nimittas, these are brilliant states. You really are getting somewhere in your practice of Buddhism. You're getting close to the Dharma. And each one of you have done that. That gives you goosebumps. At least I remember it gave me goosebumps when I saw some of the meditations I've got and then read what the Buddha said about them. This is big time stuff. You're in the big league. Wow. And that really sort of made me, with a goosebump. But you're doing that. Why? Because unlike many other people, you're experiencing all your body vanish. And you're getting this beautiful light in the mind. Not many people can do that. Why is it great insight? Number one is because you're finding out what this body is, what the mind is, and what happens when things disappear. I'm now going to go on to the simile which I developed, which is one of the best similes for understanding how insight works. And answering a very common question which has already been asked in the evening. Do you need jhanas to get enlightenment insight? You know, I've already given the answer, yes. And I've quoted the sutras. Now I'm going to explain why you need the jhanas. This is my famous simile of the tadpole and the frog. Once upon a time, a little tadpole was born in a lake somewhere in Singapore. And she used to swim around, happy as could be. And then when she went to school, she heard about water. They did some lessons on water. Later on, she joined the TBF, the Tadpole Buddhist Fellowship, where she heard people talking about the nature of water, and she even heard this frog from Burma teach the Abhidharma on the nature of water. But even though she studied water, did you think the tadpole could ever really understand what water was? Little tadpole, she'd been born in water. All her life she'd lived surrounded by water. Even though she knew the theory, she even knew how to say water in Mandarin and Hokkien, as well as in Pali and Sanskrit, she still didn't understand what water was. And then one day, little tadpole, she woke up in the morning, she found there were things growing out of her, at the bottom and at the chest. And little by little, it grew and grew and grew. She had little legs and little arms. Little tadpole had become a frog. And one day, little frog jumped out of the water and stood on the dry land. You know, that must be a very weird experience, the first time a frog jumps out of the water, because something which was always there has now vanished. Something she'd been born in and lived all her life in is no longer there. Ah, said little frog, Now I know what water is, that strange stuff which is now missing. A fish can never understand water. You can never understand air. It's always there. Can you see the air? Can you feel the air? Can you taste the air? It probably has got a taste. It probably has got a smell. But because it's always been there, you can't notice it or see it. Just like a frog or a tadpole boiling water. But one day when the water disappears, then you know what water was. Now in that simile you can understand, even limiters, especially jhanas. Your body, do you know what your body is? Can you really understand the nature of your body and see, hear, smell, taste and touch it? Your five senses? Yeah, you've all assumed you know. How can you? The body's always been there for you. When you wake up in the morning, your body's there again. All through the day, every moment of your waking life, this body and the five senses are there for you. Just like water is surrounding the tadpole. You think you know, but you don't. But one day, all your little tadpoles sitting in front of you, one day, you grow into a frog. You let go of the five senses and the body disappears. You get limited, you get jealous. Wow! Something is missing. What's missing? Our five senses and the body. Now you understand what they are. And you also recognize this beautiful peace, this bliss. And those of you who have got these deep meditations, you keep going back again because they're incredible. I love telling that story. You know, when I first got my first deep meditation, I still had a girlfriend. And, you know, I'm honest with everybody, had sex with her about 4 or 5 days beforehand. And then you were meditating. I say that because I had recent experience, you know, of good sex. And now I had good meditation. And that blew me away. This is much better than sexual orgasm. Way, way better. It lasts much longer and you don't have the problems with maybe babies. It's much, much better. And my first reaction to that is, why hadn't anybody told me about this? This is far better. Why doesn't anybody know about this? It was weird. Now, the best bliss you've ever had in your life, and you discovered it almost by accident, and it really sort of blew me away. And later on you ask, why was that so happy? You realize because something which was a great burden was being gone. Your body had five senses. When the Buddha talks about suffering, the suffering of the body, you don't understand it. I can say that, yeah, I know the body is sick sometimes, and you get old, it's aching, but that's not what the Buddha means by suffering. You only know that when the body vanishes. It's like this big burden has gone. It's like you've been carrying around this really heavy rocks in the backpack, and now you put them down for the first time in your life. Oh, this is so good. I'm free at last. Being free of your body. Now I want you to experience that. Incredible bliss. It's not just for the sake of having fun, which is, you know, worth it anyway. But it's what it means. Why was that joyful? Why was that blissful? Now you understand why the Buddha kept on saying this body is suffering. Don't get involved in it too much. Look after it. But it is the whole bag of suffering. But even more than that, when you really get into the deep meditation, second time and above, this happens. Something else disappears. And this is big time disappearance. In the second jhana, you're totally still. Nothing moves at all. It's like the whole world is frozen. That your body and mind are like a rock, an immovable mountain. And you can't even do anything. You are stuck. Because something has vanished. something which has always been there for you. Something which has surrounded you. You may not have exercised it, but it's always been at your fingertips, so to speak. Your will. This thing which chose to come here. This thing which chooses what food it's going to have for lunch. This thing which decides to stay or go. Your will. Do you understand what that is? No, you don't. No more than a tap ball can understand what water is. Because your will has surrounded you ever since you were born. It's never left you. Whenever you want it, you can choose this, you can choose that. You've had so-called autonomy. Now, with the second jhana and beyond, that vanishes. It's not there anymore. That is one of the weird experiences of the deeper jhanas. The total absence of something which has always been there, called your will. Now you can understand what that is. And that's scary. Finding out who's running your show. It's not God, it's not a person, just a process. Now you see that for yourself very clearly, simply because the frog sees what water is once it's jumped out. If it can't jump out, it just will not be able to know. That is why I encourage people to get these shining experiences. That is why if you have lots of these experiences, you'll find you'll start to see things which you can't see otherwise. You understand what this body is, you understand what this mind is, the thing left when the body disappears, you understand what will is, you understand what observing is, consciousness is. The whole thing becomes very clear. Simply because you have jumped out of the lake. That's why the Buddha kept on saying, you have to do these jhanas. This is just the growth of a frog. And when you do, not only do you get great insight, but you get great happiness as well. Sometimes it'll be a big worry. If you get all these great insights, if you're miserable afterwards, it would be worth it, would it? But one of the great things, as I said at the beginning, when it really is an insight, it makes you more peaceful and happy afterwards. You never lose with insight. When you do get them, you realize, this body doesn't belong to me, it's a bit of a burden. Number one, you're not at all afraid of death. Great, bring it on, as George W. Bush used to say. Who wants to carry on with this old body? If you die early on, that's brilliant. So I'm not afraid of dying in a car crash. If I die in a car crash or the aircraft blows up in the sky, that's brilliant. I don't have to worry about old people's homes. Are you looking forward to going to an old people's home? Are you looking forward to having nappies again? That's what happens to you when you get really old. I always like the story of the two men, old friends, it was their 80th birthday, or at least one of them, and said, how do you feel? He said, I'm 80 today. Oh, everything aches, it's so hard to get up in the morning, and so I just have to go and see the doctor for this and the doctor for that. Every other day I'm going to the surgery, I'm really wearing out, and it's so difficult. And he asked his friend, you're about the same age as me, how do you feel? And his best friend said, me, I feel like a newborn baby. How can you feel like a newborn baby in your 80s? Well, he said, I've got no hair, I've got no teeth, and I've just wet my pants. Just like a newborn baby. That's what a newborn baby. So you're looking forward to that? Wearing nappies again? Because that's what happens, you get incontinent when you get old. You lose all your teeth. Your hair, I've always lost my hair a long time ago, so I'm not worried about that. So let's be great, so I'm not afraid of those sorts of stuff. So one of the things is, you're not this body, so forget about it. Don't worry too much. You get sick, that's just what the body does. So leave it alone. It's body doing body stuff, nothing to do with me. I realize I am only a visitor in this body. I don't own this at all. Nature owns this body, but me, I'm just a visitor. I came to rent this body 60 years ago. I don't know how long my lease is left. But I know it's not really mine. I look after it.
So we don't notice. That's a good place to stop the talk, so let's have a toilet break. Okay, so talk over, toilet break now, and hopefully we'll get some electricity by the time the toilet break is over.